Well, I'm not going to tell y'all what she said. My name is Vinaya Shaw, and I'm a member of Al-Anon.
Hi.
Before I forget, I do want to thank the committee and the chairman of the committee and the jaws of the convention for us. For inviting me here. This is really something. And a special thank you, to Heloise and Beverly. They've just absolutely treated me like I'm somebody, and that has just been overwhelming, and they've just really been precious. And I think the theme of this state conference is so very typical of alcoholics. Have any of you noticed that they've omitted the word trudge? Yeah, I'm always just absolutely scared to death when I get up here. I've never gotten over it, and last night I just couldn't sleep, and I just kept going in and out of these strange dreams and stuff, and I was having this dream, and it seemed as if I was, like, in heaven, and I was looking out, and I over something. It looked like it may have been, I don't know, gates or something. Anyway, I could look in and see a whole bunch of people like y'all are out there, and I recognized one. And it looked like Jim. And he had this big, huge, heavy, grotesque-looking, horrible thing, just black ooing goo out of it. It's just ugly and horrible, and it was chained to him. And I realized that there was a man kind of standing next to me, and I don't know, maybe it was St. Peter or somebody. He was standing there with this gate-looking thing, and I said, that looks like my friend Jim. Why has he got that thing chained to him like that? He said, well, he almost didn't make it here, and he's got to have that thing chained to him for 2,000 years. And it just really made me sad, because I loved him. Then I looked and saw, and it seemed like it was Buddy, and it had this big, huge, black contraption with these wheels just spinning all over it, and it was chained to him. And I said, oh, that's Buddy, and he's been real sick. How come he's got that thing chained to him? And this gatekeeper said, he almost didn't make it here, and he's got to be chained to that thing for the next 6,000 years. And it's really made me, real sad. And then I looked, and it really was Clancy. I mean, I could, you can't miss Clancy. I saw Clancy. And he had, of all things, with Cale Welch chained to him. And I said, hey, what's the deal? He said, Raquel almost didn't make it up here. I heard that from a guy that used to be my friend. He's a baby of Clancy's, and his name is Clint H. And he said that he had finally found the difference between alcoholics and Al-Anons, that several personalities, and he discovered Al-Anons had one or less. Everybody know that August the 1st, I'm organizing 25,000 Al-Anons to march on California. My sponsor came up to my room, and she's here today, and that's really a treat. She came up to my room a while ago, and she said, this is really something. Can you imagine when you first walk into Al-Anon, and then here you are talking at the state convention? I said, no, I can't, I really can't imagine that. It's just an absolute overwhelming privilege to me that you've asked me, for my own state. I came into this program in February of 1969 in Lubbock, Texas, and a couple of years ago I moved to Norman, Oklahoma. And it has really been a fantastic 15 years. It's overwhelming. It's unbelievable. And it's been said over and over and over this weekend. How did any of us get where we are? And it doesn't make sense. My father came from Oklahoma. He was uneducated, half-Indian or part-Indian, and moved to Texas, met my mother, who was from a poverty family, and they married and had three brothers and myself, and a good family, a hard-working family, very quiet family. My brother, when I was really young, broke his neck, and what little they had put together, they lost, and we were really just broke. We had just lived in poverty for quite some time. When that happened, they had him in Oklahoma, and then they took him to Dallas for a lot of treatment, and he was very, very ill for a long, long time. And I didn't see my folks, but just every now and then. And I was left with friends and of the family and one aunt and uncle and kind of back and forth with them. And I made some decisions I discovered long after I got in this program when I was a child. And those decisions, I carried with me all through adult life. And some of those decisions were made then, of being out of place and just in the way. I was in the way in some of those people's home, and they were really kind. They weren't unkind to me, none of them were, but it was just like I was kind of in the way. And not too long ago, I remembered something. These people I stayed with lived out in the country, and they didn't have plumbing, and there was a great big huge tin thing that they put it in the middle of the kitchen floor on Saturday night, and she heated water on the stove and poured it into that tub. And she had three children, and each took their turn going in there and taking a bath. And then it was my turn, and I remember going in there, and I remember looking at that water, and it was so dirty, and it was gray, and it was yucky, and it was cold. And I asked her, could I please not have to get in that tub? And she said, no, you need to take a bath. So she put me in that tub, and I can remember still, the feeling of being washed in that water, and how I even felt dirtier after I got out of that water. And I remember making the decision, oh well, it was just oh well. I didn't belong to that family, and I was in the way, and I just thought I deserved to take a bath in their dirty leftover water. And that, was some decisions that started in me from this environment. My family finally did come home, and it was like a hospital there, and it was very quiet, and a lot of sickness and a lot of hospital smells there, and a lot of trouble between my mother and father because of stress and strain, and it was a very quiet home. There wasn't a lot of laughter. There was no laughter going on there. There was not much going on there. My dad went off to work. My mom stayed there and took care of my brother, and they had taken all of us to church before this happened. I was really young, so I don't remember much about it, but I remember being there in church. And I remember one day when I was there that some ladies came in and they brought sacks and sacks of groceries in. And I just knew that they were from church. And it made my mother cry, and it made my daddy walk out in the backyard, and he had his head kind of hung down. And I didn't particularly like those women, because the only thing that I knew about them is they made my mother cry and my daddy go out in the backyard. So I wasn't really thrilled with church or those people or anything that, seemed to be doing, had anything to do with that. And I hate to say this, but I was kind of probably one personality or less. And I've been this tall since I was three, and extremely skinny and no personality, not much anything, just from a quiet place that felt like I was in everybody's way. And I found a place when I was about 17 or 18 years old that was the most exciting place I had ever seen in my life. And we call them West Texas honky tonks. And God, there was something out there. It was just a magic out there that happened. Those dark lights and that noise and the excitement and the people. And God loved it. And I found out that at midnight, out at those places, some other wonderful things could happen too. My folks did teach me the things that all little girls are taught, and gave me the things that all of us, know we're supposed to do, and the things that you're not supposed to do. And I knew all those things. But out there in that environment, I found something that was really important to me. be touched, to be held, to be hugged. I didn't experience that at home. I don't ever remember my mother nor my father ever hugging me or ever touching me or ever being in their lap. I don't remember those things. I don't think it ever happened. I don't know. I don't ever remember them saying to me, I love you. I don't ever remember them saying much to me at all, to tell you the truth. I was just kind of in and out. So out there in that honky-tonk, I found that I could be held and touched, and I also learned that there was a price to pay to do that. But it didn't really matter. It was another one of those old wells. And so I lost my dignity out there, and I lost my womanhood out there, or my childhood. I became a woman, is that quote. And the honky-tonks that I was going to, they were really bad places, and there were some really bad places. People in there, most of the places were called the after-hours joints, and certainly weren't any social drinkers, I'll tell you. There wasn't any society or social to it. It was a really bad place. And I had my own dignity stripped out there, and I saw the dignity of lots and lots of people stripped out there. It was a terrible thing. You know, I just could never claim the fact that I was a sweet little young thing that found this man and he started drinking and my life went crazy. You know, I've always been a squirrel looking for a tree to climb up. Always, always, always. And I have loved alcoholics. I just love them. I do today. You know, one of the major things I had to do was to realize that I needed and wanted the alcoholic personality in my life. And I've had, I say, three major alcoholics and a whole bunch of minor alcoholics in between. I met my first major alcoholic in for lack of a better word, he was just a gangster. And we began to live together. Now, he had something that really fascinated me, and that was money. And he was free with it, and he gave me that, and Chuck, God, it's just really something. And so we wound up living together. And I found myself pregnant by him. And back in those days, you know, people did not live together like they do and talk about today. And they call them meaningful relationships, I believe, today. And we call it, you know, shacking up. And I was just shacked up with him and found myself pregnant, you know. And I hated that. I really hated that. And after that baby was born, it was a little girl. And he asked me and she to, he asked us if we would leave, that he didn't want the responsibility of us, and so I did. I left with this brand new baby, and I was very hurt and very scared and very resentful, and so I did what, you know, I thought the thing to do was to get him back, pay him back for what he had done to me. And so I started flaunting myself in front of him and all the people that he knew with another man that he absolutely hated. They were just deadly enemies, and made a big thing out of this. And one night he took a shotgun and blew this man's head off. They came and told me about that, and it was just absolutely too overwhelming for me to experience. And I did something that I learned, and I don't know how I learned to do it that particular time, but I learned to do it and kept it for many years, and that's called stuffing my feelings. I felt the guilt for about that long, and I did something with it, and I don't know what it was, but I did something with it, and didn't feel it. And my mother asked me if I would never come back to their home. And if anybody asked if I was their daughter, would I please say no? And I said, of course I will. And no, I won't be back. And, you know, I didn't blame them. They were good people, and they certainly didn't, you know, they didn't deserve that kind of stuff. And they had a long road back to trying to get some money put together prior to that. And they'd spent a lot of money trying to keep their name out of the newspaper. And I disgraced my family with that whole situation. And I had this daughter. You know, and I loved her. but also resented her. You know, she was a reminder of that whole situation. And every time I looked at her, I'd feel it and I'd think it. And it was just really tough with my daughter, and I've carried guilt for that for a long, long time. I decided the thing to do was change the people that I knew and to get better, you know, just do something different and get feeling better inside. And so I started going to a different honky-tonk. I started going where the cowboys went, and I thought, you know, cowboys, now that's red-blooded all-American folks, and if I could just get married, if I could just be married, you know, everything would be all right. I could get married and maybe go to PTA and maybe bake cookies and do kitchen windows, and he could mow the lawn, and, you know, that would make me all right. Didn't occur to me a long time that I don't like to sew and I can't bake and, you know, PTA's a drag. But anyway, I went out and found the very best looking, the best drinker, and the toughest looking, the best bull rider that there was out in the cowboy honky-tonk. And one night, he was beating me in the chest with his finger, and I took a beer bottle and busted it over his head, and in a few minutes, he said, you know, I think you've just really knocked some sense into me. I think we should get married. And I said, I think we should, too. And we did, and we had a fabulous marriage for the first 6 days. It was absolutely wonderful. And then the sixth day, he went out with Charlie for a minute, and he'd be right back, and... You know, that started something that was just there for years. And the only difference in these two men is one wore a pistol, one wore a cowboy hat. You know, they were just exactly the same. They both drank the same, and I had the same reactions to them. Both these men were very physically violent with me, and, you know, I accepted it. And one of those decisions I made when I was a child was that I was guilty. I didn't know what I was guilty of, but I was guilty. And so I allowed this physical violence. Been thrown through windows and out car doors, and I've been shot at and stabbed and pistol whipped and knuckled and rocked and just a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I just, it was one of those old wells. That's the way it was. And I thought, maybe if I could give him a son, he would stay home and everything would be all right, and, you know, we'd tippy-toe. And so I gave him a son, and, you know, it didn't do a bit of good. You know, it was nothing different, absolutely totally nothing. And I did all the things that I think all of us do that's in that insanity and tried. And everything was my fault. Everything was. If I would just clean the house better, he wouldn't do this, that, or the other. So I'd clean the house better. If I'd do the clothes better, he wouldn't do this, that, and the other. If I had better sex life, he'd do this. Boy, I bought books. You wouldn't believe the books I bought. If I do this better, you know. And I did everything. I tried to do everything better. And nothing was, you know. If I did them all, there was always one more thing that I didn't do right. And he would tell me things that I really began to start to believe. You know, I started to believe a lot of things that he said and believe that I really was a nothing and a nobody, because that's what he told me all the time. And I kind of knew that anyway, and he just confirmed it, and I knew it. And I stayed away from friends. There was no friends. There was nobody left anymore. And just me and those two children, and I had... one girl, one friend of mine. One Thursday, you know, I don't know why, but just one Thursday. I knew that I had, you know, I just couldn't handle it anymore. And I decided that I would kill myself. And I was trying to think of a really, truly, this is the honest truth. I was trying to think of a way to kill myself for a while. You know, if I could get into one of those deep comas just on the edge of death for a while, just to get out of it, I just, you know, I couldn't handle it anymore, and I didn't know what to do. And I looked at those kids, and they were in the other room, and they weren't playing. They were just busying themselves, staying out of my way. They were just staying out of my way. They stayed out of my way, and they stayed out of the way of this man, too. You know, Johnny's always touched me when he talks about what it's like to be a child in a alcoholic home. The screaming and the fighting and the flesh hitting flesh in the middle of the night. You know, that's what my kids were in. I discovered after I got in this program that stopped. A lot of that stopped. And one of the things I discovered, I was told to try to keep my mouth shut. And instead of going forward, why not back up a little every now and then? And, you know, that really did stop. I did not realize until I was in this program that I was a great part of starting that violence. I was a big part of that. But this Thursday, I sat there and I remembered an article that I'd read in Ann Landers, and it was talking about a lady who was talking about a drinking situation, and Ann Landers had told her to call AA and ask about Al-Anon. And for some reason, that came in my head, and I had read this 6 months, a year before that. And I like to say now, because I really believe this is true, I like to think that thought came in my head as a result of some prayers my grandmother probably just ricocheted from heaven and just hit right in my mind, because my grandmother had never quit praying for me. And I picked up the phone and I talked to an AA lady and her husband. And they took me to my first meeting. And that's always so important for me to remember. You know, it's important for me to remember this, too, to thank you, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, for allowing me to share your podium as an Al-Anon. Because AA and open AA meetings have done so much for me. And these two people, these two members of AA, took me to my first meeting. They didn't, you know, shoo me off because I was just an Al-Anon. They cared and they took me to a meeting. And I remember that meeting just like it was yesterday. I think it was Dottie last night saying, God, it doesn't seem like, you know, 20 years. It just does not. It was like yesterday. And the very first impression that I got was some laughing. I saw some laughter, two guys laughing. And it just, I just stood there, went on in that meeting and listened to the meeting. And I couldn't tell you what they said. I have no earthly idea what they said. And I left. And I knew that I was going to be back. There was a feeling, and I didn't even know it was a feeling. I just knew I was going to be back. Many years later, I read something that I think describes that. It's in a book called The Prophet, and it says, say not that God is in your heart, but that you're in the heart of God. And I truly believe that's what happened to me, that I walked into the heart of God. I didn't know it at the time. But that spirit that's here, and I think it's been talked about, that whatever, I just wanted to come back, and I did, and I came back, and I came back, and I came back. I was so afraid if I opened my mouth and y'all knew where I came from, you would ask me to leave. So I didn't say anything for a long time. I was quite convinced that nobody in there had ever said shit in their life. And I thought, God, if they know me and where I'm from, I won't be welcome here, so I'm not going to say anything. I just want to come in and sit down and listen and absorb this and get out. And so I did that for a long time. And then one night, this lady stopped me and caught me at the door. And she said something to me. It was very personal, she said, told me later in her life, and she didn't know why, particularly at that time, she was sharing it, but she was, and it was something I needed to hear. And later that lady became my sponsor. And she's still my sponsor today. And she's a magnificent lady, and I love her. She was in my room a while ago, and we knelt and prayed together. And that was at my request. And I remember she took me to my first conference, and we were sitting in another bedroom, and she grabbed my hand this time, and she said, let's say a prayer. And I'm telling you, I want to get up and run out of there. I was so embarrassed, I could not believe it. She... Cricket, that religious spiritual freak was praying over me. And today I asked her to kneel and pray with me. You know, that's something. And she started telling me how to work this program, and she started me with some things that, if, you know, I still do today. And her husband, Jack, spent so many hours with me telling me about the disease of alcoholism and talking to me and sharing with me, and just hours. And I just still to this day think he's the Rock of Gibraltar. I just feel good just standing around him. You know, he doesn't have to say anything. I just like to just be with him. And I was given a big book. And I shall forever, forever, forever be grateful that I was given a big book and I was told to read it. I'm so glad I came to this fellowship when I did, when that wasn't even questioned. You just got a big book. And I read about the disease of alcoholism, and I read about the doctor's opinion about it, and I read the stories in the back first, and it gave me some hope and some insight. And God, it was just glorious to me. And I was told to read the chapter 4, you know, how to get this, you know, this deal inside of me and how to work it. And I don't know. Hours spent with me. No matter what dime of the night or day I could call him, there was always an answer, and there was always some words and something to do. It still amazes me today, you know, because when I got here, I didn't love anybody. I didn't care about anybody. I didn't trust anybody. I didn't feel anything. And this lady, I trusted immediately. And she said some things to me that just overwhelmed me. And the first one that she said, and she looked me right there in the eye, and she'd say, "But no, I really love you." And, you know, I believed her. I believed that she loved me. And when she'd say that, I could not look at her. I'd have to look down or look up or look off. I just couldn't believe that she really could say that out loud to me, and she could really feel it. And she did. It's the first time I ever remember anybody saying that and believing it. I'd heard it a lot, and as I say, I heard it before, afterwards, or during, but she meant it. And I'm telling you, I just worshipped her. She was my higher power for a long, long time. And I believed every word she said. I hung on every word she said. And you know, today, she didn't remember half the stuff she told me. I mean, you know, I was just overwhelmed with her. And she'd say, "Gosh, that's good. Where'd you get that?" And, you know, she told me that 14, 15 years ago, and it's been my whole life. And she said, "Huh." And I lovingly say this. I'm not real sure I'm brave enough to say this today, but she loved me and was a lot of love and acceptance for a while. And then all of a sudden she turned into a tittle of a hun's sister, you know, just, "We're going to get on with the working of these steps," she told me one day. And I told her I did not know about this God business, and she said to me over and over and over, "I don't care how you feel, it's the results that we're after. It's the results of taking these steps." And so I began as she instructed me, and I took the step. And I remember taking my first stab at a fourth step and taking that fifth step with her. I didn't want to take it with her because she really was my higher power. And I wanted her love and acceptance more than anybody ever knew. And I knew if she knew all that stuff about me, that was going to be the end of it. And I didn't know if I could stand it if I didn't have her in my life. But I knew I had to. And I left out a couple of things on that inventory. You know, enough is enough and Jiminy Cricket. But I took it with her. And after that, I watched her like a hawk. Ah. I'd see how she looked at me when she first came in the room. I'd see where she'd go sit, and I'd watch her. And, you know, the thing that she said to me when that was over with is she thanked me. She said, "I want to thank you for trusting me enough to share this with me." And she did change. I think she loved me more. I really did. A couple of months after that, I went to my first City Glen conference up by Amarillo, and there was a speaker there, and God, all she talked about was the fifth step and being honest and thorough and all that. And afterwards, I was told by my sponsor to go talk to her because I was just crying. I was just miserable. And I went to talk to her, and she said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I don't know. My sponsor just said for me to talk to you, and you'd know what to do." And she said, "Well, have you taken your fifth step?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I've already done that." She said, "Well, let's get to what you left out then." You know. And I did. I told her everything, and I'll guarantee you if I forgot anything, she remembered it. And told that woman everything. And she told me to go find some bubble bath and go get the big book and read what it said on sixth and seventh step and kneel and take that seventh step prayer and to go get some sleep, that I would have a wonderful night's sleep, and then to start watching to see what God was going to do. And I did those things the next day. I honestly and truly believe for the first time in my life I encountered God. And I started crying, and I cried through that whole weekend. And my false eyelashes fell off and they were just, yeah. And I looked at people in the eye for the very first time in my life. I looked you right in the eye, and I didn't look off and I didn't look down. And I was able to hug and receive hugs, and it was just absolutely glorious. I just, you know, somebody'd say good morning, and I'd just say, yes. Oh, it was like being scrubbed inside with an SOS pad. And I felt clean, and I felt whole, and I felt like a lady for the very first time in my life. I knew it wasn't lost. I knew I could have it. I went back home, and I started doing the other things that I was told to do, and I started making the amends. And Jiminy Crickets, the things that have come in my life because of amends, I could spend 4 days talking about it. The first one I was able to make was to a gal that I'd worked with, and just couldn't stand her. She was the most smart-alecky, smart, you know, just, ugh. And she was on my amends list for some reason or other, and I hadn't seen her in years, just absolute years. And I was invited to a shower just a couple days after I came home from this conference. And I went to that shower, and the very first person I saw when I opened the door was her. And for me, I made a big amend. I said, hello, how are you? And, you know, years later, God gave me a second chance. I think that's what's so marvelous. He gives me chances after chances after chances. Years later, I ran into this lady, and she was dying of cancer. And my father was dying of cancer. And we just bumped into each other, and we sat down, and we had a cup of coffee, and we talked about an hour and a half about the things that we could not talk about to our loved ones. And it was just absolutely marvelous. It's one of those full circles. And I think that's so beautiful, because that first attempt at amends to me was very, you know, useless, but God let me do it. I lived with this practicing alcoholic doing all these things for 7 years after I first came to Al-Anon. And he drank all that time. And there was times when I literally had to fight my way, physically fight my way out the door to get to meetings. And I just don't have any patience with people who tell me they're too tired or it's too far or whatever and whatever, it's too cold, it's snowing or whatever. To go to meetings, I just said, I don't have patience, because I had to fight my way here many, many times. And I knew if I wasn't here that there wasn't going to be anything anyway. And so I came here over and over and over. The violence had stopped. It had been a long, long time. In this seventh year, one night in the middle of the night, he came in, and I could tell that he was in total insanity, and he was in a blackout, and he flipped on that light, and he got me before I even knew what was happening. And I was all tangled up in the sheets, and I was trying to get away, and he was just beating the snot out of me. I was just going over the foot of the bed, and just before I hit the floor, I looked up, and there was my two children just dancing a little jig and just begging their father not to hit Mom anymore. Please don't hit her anymore. And as I hit that floor, I thought, I really don't have to put up with this. So I didn't put up that. I left. I had left. You know, I had left and left and come back and left and come back and left and come back. But this, I knew this was it. This was it. And I started really scared. You know, I mean, I was scared. I was a high school dropout. I didn't know how to do anything but stand behind a cash register and punch keys. And I knew I had these two children and that wasn't going to cut it. And I didn't know what to do. And I went to my sponsor and she said, well, we're really going to, you know, God's going to do something. He'll do something. And so I started praying, and she started praying with me. And strange thing, I mean, 1, 2, 3, it came, and people came to me and suggesting nursing school. And after I realized the third, my sponsor always says, listen, if 3 times something said to you that could be God, and you better perk up your ears. So the third one said that, and I thought, oh, God, let's think of something else. You know, I get car sick. I just couldn't imagine bedpans. I mean, that was just beyond me. But anyway, as I'm told to do, I just started looking and seeking and finding out, and there was a man, and he may possibly be here today. I think he's out with the golfers who golf on Saturdays and don't listen to poor little humble Al-Anon. But he worked at this rehabilitation center. He was in the program, and he helped me get in touch with some people. There was a lady in our group who worked for the Texas Welfare, and she got me on welfare. There was some lots and lots of people. A man that I had started trusting and believing in, who was a pastor of a church, helped me. And before I knew it, I was enrolled in school. My way was being paid, and I was on welfare. And I was in nursing school. Now, let me tell you, I'm not one that liked to ask for help anyway, but good Lord, all the stuff I had to ask for during that time was just unbelievable, and to be on welfare was not my favorite thing. And I began a thing that happened several times later on. I began a little angry at God, but I certainly didn't say anything. You know, you're not angry at God. Oh, God's good to you, and you're a good Al-Anon, and you say the Serenity Prayer, and you say, oh, well, and you go on. And I didn't like being on welfare. It was degrading. And I had to go down to this place and stand in line and pick up food commodities. And God, I just hated it. And we had a lot of canned chicken and canned Spam. God, I'll tell you, that's just the most, I can't eat it today. And right before I got off, they did something even worse. They started out with those food stamps. And then I had to go out to the public and to stores with those food stamps. And I'd go clear across town, and I'd do everything in the world to keep from anybody seeing me with these welfare food stamps. It just ate me out of lunch. And this lady that got me on this, I talked to her about it, and she was so kind and so loving and just a fabulous lady, and she kept saying, it's going to be all right. There's a purpose, you know, it's going to be all right. Yes, you deserve it. Those kids deserve it. She just really talked me through a lot of that. And my sponsor said, there'll be a purpose, there'll be a reason. You may never know it, but there is. And later on, I was several things. That lady that helped me through all that, lady was very ill, and I was able to take care of her. And she died, and it's a real privilege. And you know, the night that I graduated from nursing school, she was in the audience. My parents were in the audience. My sponsor was in the audience. And you know, that whole nursing class asked me if I would get up and give the class response. You know, me. And I looked out there, and there was this lady that had helped me, and tears was rolling down her eyes, and there was my father, tears was rolling down his eyes, and there was my mother, tears rolling down her eyes. And my mother and father were proud of me, and they were glad that I was their daughter. And I bet if anybody asked, they'd have told them I was. And you know, I got to take care of my father when he was dying. I made him comfortable, and I loved him. And he said to me before he died that I was his favorite kid. He may have told him all that, but he certainly told me that, and I believed it. I left this man and single in the program. Boy, I'll tell you, that's a trip to be a single in the program. I had to make excuses for why I was there. I realized that one night I didn't have to. My sponsor said, if anybody asked that, just tell them you're there because you want to be. And then these kids, God Almighty, these kids all of a sudden were grown, and my daughter was 16 and sneaking out windows and doing a little drinking and lying and things that they do, and it just got really bad. And by this time, Pat was gone, and I had another sponsor named Octavian. I went to Octavia and said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do about this deal. And she said, well, do like you always do and work the steps. And so I did. And I told my daughter, you're either going to have to do something or you're going to have to leave. And I assumed she'd do something, but she didn't. In the middle of the night, one night, she took off. And there's a line in the big book that says, we ask God for his protection and care with complete abandon. And so I did that for my daughter. And I figured she'd be out there for a while, and then she'd get in trouble, and she'd come home and straighten up, and everything would be wonderful. And she was gone about 6 weeks, and one night, in the middle of the night, I got a call, and she had been drunk and passed out in front of a honky-tonk, and two men had crawled in the car with her and done her real bad. And the overwhelming guilt came for that long, and I stuffed it. And I went and got her, and I had had lots and lots and lots of problems with this daughter of mine. I was trying to work on loving her and touching her, and I was told to, at night before she went to bed, to go in there and after she went to bed, pull the covers over and fix her and pat her on the head and fix her hair, and that'll give you some touching. And when she comes through the room, touch her and pat her, and I was really trying to work on that. I'd never been able to hug her. And when I got to that hospital room, I was standing for the bed, and this is so amazing to me because I just had never and seen God answer prayer so quick, and it just I remember this constantly. He can answer a prayer just as quick as anything in the world. I was standing before that bed, and I said something like this. I don't remember exactly, but, you know, God, if you've ever used me as a channel, please use it now. And let me go around there and hug that daughter and hold her and tell her she's all right. And by the time I got to the foot of the bed, the side of that bed, she had buried her head in the pillow. She didn't want to see me. And when I got there to the side of that bed, I was able to pick her up and hold her and love her and caress her and say out loud, I love you. It's going to be all right. It was a marvelous experience. And since that time, we've really had a better relationship than we've ever had. I was able to sit her down and tell her where I came from because I'd lied about it and lied and lied and lied about her real father. Right before this happened, her real father got out of the penitentiary, and I talked with him and tried to make some amends to him, and he heard about this incident with her, and he had never seen her. He hadn't seen her since she was about 3 or 4 weeks, months old. Then he called and he said, I want to do something for that little girl. He said, I'm going to give you some money and I want you to take her and buy her some white silk pajamas. And buy her some popcorn, take her to a movie, make her feel like a little girl again. That's okay. And he brought the money and he brought her a car. And, you know, I found in his way he was trying to make his amends. I thought he was such a black part of my life. He was just a terrible black thing. I just didn't like to talk about him. I didn't like to have any thoughts about him in my mind. And I didn't want to take that money from him. And I was talking to a sober member of AA, and he said, well, you little prude. You know, his money was gambling money, and I just didn't want to take it. And he said, that man is trying to do something for you and that daughter. He's got a lot of guilt, and don't do that to him. So I accepted the money. I was a little prudish. I didn't want that kind of money. Isn't that ridiculous? And so I took the money, and it made her feel real good. And right after that, she met her real father for the very first time. My son, shortly thereafter, my little darling son, God, I could love and hold that kid. He was just precious, just precious. And I could just do anything with him. And one day, he was 11 years old, a school call, and he was gotten into a bunch of stuff. And he was high on Pam, sniffing Pam or something. And went and got him. And you know, just amazed me. I had a long time out on that point. And I said, son, what world did you do that? And he said something to me that just absolutely put me in terror. He said, Mama, I've been doing it because I like the way it makes me feel. And I'll tell you, my anger at God came up one more time, and I stuffed it again. I thought, gee, I've lost my husband, I lost my daughter, and now my son to this disease, and I just absolutely cannot handle this. I just can't handle it. And I knew I couldn't, I knew I wouldn't. And I tried to find some things to do, and was going to put him in the boys' ranch. And I got a lot of support through that, because I'll tell you, that was the toughest decision I ever made. And right before I was supposed to take him, his still-drinking father found out about this and stole him one night and kept him, and I didn't know where he was, and it was just terrible. And I finally found him, and I went to judges and lawyers and attorneys and child welfare. I went everywhere, and there was no way I could get him back. And my ex-cousin threatened to go away and take him where I'd never ever see him again, and I believed him. Besides that, my son wanted to be with his father. And I thought, you little ingrate. You know, you just little ingrate. I couldn't believe he did that to me. You know, me, I was his mother. I had taken care of him, and I'd gotten him away from that monster, and I'd done all these things, and hell, he wanted to go live with the old fart. I just... And he's with him today, and he's 16, and he's still there. They're living right now behind a bar on the other side of town, a very dangerous part of town, and that's where they're living, in a little shack behind a bar, and that's where he chooses to live. He won't come live with me, and I've had lots of problems with that. I deal with that deal one day at a time, a lot of the time. His father won't let him come see me. He tells him that I was trying to give him away so I could go do all these things with all the members of AA. And I don't know what my son believes anymore. I really don't. But one of the things that just really killed me about that is that, you know, I didn't know my son was doing that. I was so busy being a good Al-Anon. I had lots of people in my home and was going to lots of meetings and going off to conventions, and my little kid was dying right on my own feet, and I didn't know it. And I had to deal with that. So there I found myself alone. My kids were doing their deal. You know, my daughter was gone, my son was gone, and I was doing my deal and just really doing pretty good. I did as what I could with those kids, and I was kind of walking alone and kind of okay. And I met this man at a convention. He was from California. He had a lot of sobriety, and he was just a really nice man, and I really liked him, and we started seeing each other. And at the end of about 9 months, he asked me if I'd come to California, and we could spend more time together, and maybe possibly get married, and we was going to tiptoe through the tulips, and I was just ready, and I quit my job, and gave away all my furniture, and gave away my kitchen, and just, you know, everything, and was ready to go. And I mean, it's 11th and a half hour. You ought to get on your hands and knees. The 11th and a half hour, he chickened out and just dumped me. And, I'll tell you all the stuff that I had done about my anger at God come unstuffed, I assure you. And there's a lady here today named Pitsy, and she's in this front row, and some friends of mine took me over there the next day, and Pitsy loved me and talked to me, and she said, "You need to go to Pat and Jack in Austin." And I thought, I don't want to. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. And Pitsy went to the phone, and she made me reservations and put me on that plane. And I got down there, and my sponsor started trying to talk to me, you know. And first time I ever remember, I just jumped up and really cussed her. And she said, "I'm not going to try to fix you. I'm just going to let you sit here and hurt." And that night, she came in and she rubbed my back with some lotion, and she gave me this old pink soft pillow. It had a satin cover on it. She said, "Here, maybe you need to hug this, or maybe you need to hit it, but here." And she just went off and left me. You know, and that's really important for me, remember, too. Sometimes I don't need to be fixed. I just need to be hurt and ugly. And she let me be that. She let me be ugly, and she didn't try to fix me. She just let me be and rubbed my back and gave me a pillow. You know, I think that's pretty neat. And I came back home, and I had some attitudes and actions I thought I'd never have. I was in such rebellion and such anger, and I used and abused a lot of people in AA. And I just hate that, because, you know, AA and the members of it have been so good and so kind and so loving and so accepting me, and I just hated it. And I hated myself. And I just couldn't get out of it for a while. And finally somebody snitched to my sponsor, and she tore the hide off my back and began to put me back together and started me all over again. This program was step one. And I had just lost it. I mean, I had lost it. I thought, I've got 12 years in this program. I've given it everything that I know to give it. And everybody else that gets up behind the podium are married and have always been married, and he's the president of his company, and she's an excellent Al-Anon, and they have the granddaughters just crawl up in their lap and goo, and the sun is just, and there's tears streaming there, and everything's just wonderful. And, you know, I thought, one more time I was thinking, what's wrong with me? What have I got left out? What's wrong with me? And I was just a horrible mess. And I had been so ashamed of myself and my actions that I could not even approach God. There was just no way I'd approach him. And I was told once again to take the third step like I'd never taken it before. And I had to ask God to forgive me. And it was really a tough thing. God didn't talk back to me, and I didn't feel no warm, goozy, nothing. I felt cold and very alone, and I felt cold and alone for a long, long time. And it finally occurred to me one night that I had everything that anybody had ever really wanted in this life. I'd already had it.
I really had. I'd had friendships, I'd had love, I'd had marriage, I had children, I had lots of money, I had no money. I had everything. I had this fellowship. And if I never get anything else again, I was way ahead of the game. Now, Scott, if you just let me go there, if you just let me be a part of, you know, that's all. And I learned that God loved me just the way that I am. Boy, that was a lesson for me. He loves me just the way I am. I don't have to be good or do good. I thought that's what it was. I literally did. And I didn't have to do a thing. And I learned that I became everything that I judged. And I'll guarantee you the right to judge other people has been stripped from me because I became everything that I judge you for doing. And I learned that God has his own timing in my life and that I can trust that. About the time I was coming out of that horrible time, and it was nearly a year that I was in that terrible mess. About the time I was coming out of it and kind of okay and feeling good, I had a Californian come back through Texas on his way to Oklahoma. And we started seeing each other again, and we were married, and we got a second year anniversary come up in a couple of weeks. And so I moved to Oklahoma. And it's really been fantastic there. It's been wonderful. And I thought, God, this is it. You know, I'm away from those kids and everything's great. And I'm just, you know, he's so wonderful. And we're going to be AA and Al-Anon and all over everywhere. And it was, and it is good. But about a year later, I got a call. And my daughter had gotten drunk and had taken well over a lethal dose of pills to kill herself. And one of the hardest things I ever did was stay in Oklahoma. I did not go. I did not go to her. Patty told me a long time ago, she said, don't ever change this program. Just give it away exactly the way you got it. Don't add anything or take anything away. Just give it away. Because someday you may need those people that you sponsor. And one of the girls that I sponsor had gone to my daughter and was taking care of her and took her to AA for a couple of weeks. And she decided she's non-alcoholic and she's out there doing whatever she needs to be doing. But that night when they told me that, when I hung up, I was so angry at my daughter. I was so mad at her. I thought, God, I wish she'd have made it. I wish she'd just have made it. I wish she was dead and I wouldn't have to worry about this anymore. It'd be off my mind. And I just, God, I just wish she'd have made it. And I'm just going through all this stuff, and then it dawned on me what I was thinking about my daughter. And then that guilt came, you know, that overwhelming guilt. I had been such a lousy, sorry mother, and here I am wishing my daughter dead, and God, it just ate me up. And I didn't tell anybody about that for about a month. I kept a secret. And boy, when I keep a secret, I don't care if it's just a thought. If I keep a secret, I got a block between me and God, and it just don't work. And I finally tracked Pat down and told her what I had been thinking and what I'd been through. She said something to me that I've got to remember. She said, Al-Anon sometimes teaches almost a fallacy. That once you come into Al-Anon, if you still have a practicing alcoholic, everything's going to be wonderful and you're not ever going to think about that or feel that pain anymore. And that's just not true. There is always a grief when you love a practicing alcoholic. There's a grief there. The difference is that Al-Anon teaches me how to deal with that. And it is, I'm not obsessed with it anymore. You know, the only thing that's going on with me is I'm sad and I hurt. But it's not, you know, the obsession any longer. And I'm glad I learned that. That was in October. And in December, I called home. First time in my life. I'd never been home for Christmas. And I called home. And I talked to my daughter. And absolutely, the most marvelous thing that's ever happened to me, I suppose, happened. The guilt was gone. There was no guilt. And I don't know when that happened. Sometime between October and December, God removed the guilt from me and let me see that I did the best I knew how. And that God has no grandchildren, and that whatever those kids need, he would, you know, he'd put it in their life. And she didn't die when she wanted to. He was taking care of her, and I somehow or another have been able almost all the time to release my children. Last Thanksgiving, my mom and my stepdad and my daughter were coming to see me. First time ever in my home, and it was just marvelous. And they pulled up in the drive, and this other little kid got out of the back seat and was my son. My mother said I had somehow conned my ex-husband and let him come. So I had my whole family there together last Thanksgiving. It was just marvelous. And they're doing whatever they need to do, and that's their deal. And most of the time I handle that all right. I have had so much trouble with self-worth, and I still have it today. It still comes and comes and comes. Many of you know Bob White. And last year, at a Canyon conference, he said something that just fixed me. It just fixes me. Another one of those amends and those full circles in my life was that, you know, I got to go over and I got to take care of Bob while he was sick. And that was such a beautiful payback for me, to just be able to sit there and take care of that man. Because he spent hours and hours and hours with me. But he said, when we always pray the Lord's Prayer, we say something at the end of that, and we talk about the kingdom and the power and the glory. And he said, if there is a kingdom, there should be a king. Any school kid knows that there's a king. And we start that prayer with our Father. So if indeed there is a king, and if indeed he is a father, that makes me his daughter, and that makes me a princess. And he said we ought to claim our heritage. And I claimed my heritage that day as he was talking about that. Since that time, I've tried to walk like a princess and act like a princess and be a princess that my father, the king, would be proud of. I really love you. I can't tell you. There's no way. There's never been any words. And these magnificent people that are in this room, there's so many of you that I love and that you've made me what I am, and you love me when I'm unlovable and you care about me. And because of your love and acceptance, not because of you telling me what was wrong with me, because of your love and acceptance, I know who I am today, and I really stand before you knowing my name is Vinoy, and I am a princess of the king. Thank you.